Welcome to part two of the series, lessons six events in Jewish history. Let's just begin with a little bit of a review from last week. Last week we talked about the anointing, the crowning of King David, a significant event which began the Davidic dynasty and ultimately the ancestry of Mashiach. We talked about King David being a person of many struggles right from the beginning, considered an outcast, had detractors, people who resisted his sovereignty, and so on and so forth. But that was his greatness. His greatness was that he was able to see the good and overcome the struggle and be resilient and be even stronger. So the lessons we learned from his life last week was, number one, never to look at the superficial. That's what God told Samuel when he wanted to anoint the older brother. And he said, no, al tabet el mar'eyu, don't look at the external exterior, because I see what's inside, so to speak. We talked about the critical ingredient of humility, to be able to do things for the right reason and not for self-gain, which is why King David had to be someone that had no anger. He felt pain but had no anger, which is why his oldest brother Eliab was the one who couldn't become the king, even though he was really qualified, but he had that trace of anger, because anger comes from ego, and then that's not a good thing for leadership. And of course, we talked about the idea of channeling, which is the idea that even originally when Samuel saw King David, he saw that he was reddish, but he had nice eyes. The red in the eyes was the combination of chesed and gevurah. Here it reminded him of Esau, and therefore he attributed to aggression, but really it was about strength and leadership, which was together with generosity and humility, and the combination was fantastic. Okay, that's a short summary. So today, I wanted to talk about a very famous person, Rabbi Akiva, and the period in which Rabbi Akiva lived in. Rabbi Akiva was one of the most fascinating Jewish Talmudic leaders that ever existed, and the period in which he lived was one of the most fascinating periods. He's so great, Rabbi Akiva is so great, that it's attributed to him the fact that we have the oral Torah today. Just like we talk about Moses giving us the Torah, which is the whole Torah, but with a greater emphasis on the five books of Moses, which is what we call the written Torah. Rabbi Akiva is the one, there were many Talmudic sages, but Rabbi Akiva is the one who's credited, so to speak, with the transmission of the oral Torah, which we have till today, we're able to study till today. But to understand the lessons of Rabbi Akiva's life, I just need to give you a little bit of a historical context. I hope that's okay. We did that last week. I think it's good just to get a historical view of what's happening. Although this is not primarily a Jewish history class, but it's always good to understand the context. So, in the year 349, before the Common Era, the Second Temple was built. Right? Just giving you the... So, the Jews came into Israel 2848, we said last week. They didn't have a temple for about 400 years. King David built the first temple, stood for 410 years. It was destroyed. They were sent into exile, the Babylonian exile. They came back around the 349. It was rebuilt. The 348 and 347 before the Common Era is where the two great leaders, Ezra and Nehemiah, led the Jewish Aliyah back from Babylon to Israel to again have a settlement in the land and have a temple. Interesting, that's a separate Jewish history discussion. Interesting, a lot of people didn't come back, actually. The first exile was to Babylon, and a lot of them stayed in Babylon, which later became Persia, and then Babylon again, and so on. So they didn't come, they actually didn't go back. They were criticized for not going back to Israel. But a large part of the Jewish population did go back to Israel, and they had the second temple. Although it didn't have sovereignty, interesting enough. They were under what was at that time a benevolent Persian sovereignty. And throughout the Second Temple, which stood for 420 years, the Persian sovereignty eventually became Greek sovereignty with Greek culture. That's when the story of Hanukkah happened, somewhere in the middle of the Second Temple. After the story of Hanukkah, the Jews had their own sovereignty for about 100 years, I think it was, the Hashmonaim, the heroes of the Hanukkah story. And eventually, the Romans took over. So, to give you an example, the Roman took over roughly around, what do I do with this? roughly around 30, 40, 50 before the Common Era, right? And Herod, the famous Herod, the builder Herod, which we have some of his buildings still today. Hurdus, as we know in the Talmud, was around the, he ruled around the year 36 before the Common Era. In the year 66, which this is now 66, currently 66, that was right, Vespasian arrived to reinforce the Roman rule. Vespasian later became the emperor of Rome, but he was for a while just a general who surrounded Jerusalem, laid siege against Jerusalem. And in the year 69, the temple was destroyed, right, under Roman rule. Some will say 70, but 69, around there, 69 or 70. So, again, the second temple was built 349 before the Common Era, 69, the year 69, it was actually destroyed. Why am I telling you that? Because it gives you a bit of a perspective. And after that, after the temple destroyed, the Jews remained under Roman rule for quite a number of years, quite a number of generations. And it was a very, very tough time. To give you a little context of what happened, they first persecuted the Jews in a much more physical, military way, right? So, for example, they destroyed the temple. They took many Jews to Rome in exile. The famous Arch of Titus is where the Jews had to march, carrying the menorah, and so on and so forth, right? But then eventually what happened was in the year 133, which was a number of years after the temple was destroyed, the last stronghold of Jewish community, which was Beitar, right? That's when the Bar Kokhba rebellion took place, and then Beitar eventually fell, and thousands and millions of Jews were actually massacred at that time. It was a very, very terrible, terrible thing, and that was like the last sort of control of Jewish control in the land of Israel fell, and the long, bitter exile began, right? However, when that happened, when the temple was destroyed, and you'll see why this is relevant for today's discussion, when that happened, what didn't fall right away was, or what wasn't persecuted right away was Torah knowledge, teaching, Jewish teaching, and Jewish legislation. Because what happened was just before the temple was destroyed, and this become relevant a little bit later, one of the sages managed to gain, this whole story in its own, one of the sages managed to gain an audience with Vespasian, who was laying siege around Jerusalem, and asked him for a favor, asked him to relocate the Sanhedrin from Jerusalem to Yavne. And the Vespasian thought he was crazy. He was about to conquer Jerusalem. He was about to destroy the temple, which was the headquarters of Jewish activity, about to exile the Jewish people, take over, make sure they don't have any control. And this guy's worried about like a Sanhedrin, a yeshiva, you know, a school of learning. So he said, yeah, no problem. And the Sanhedrin did relocate, and Yavne, and then subsequently other places, became a very strong center of Jewish learning, Jewish legislation, and Jewish teaching. Later, it was only later, towards the end of Rabbi Akiva's life, that the Romans chapped that they made a mistake, because Judaism was still alive and well. They thought they'd destroy Judaism forever, and it wasn't. And that's when they realized that it's Jewish education. Ultimately, it's going to keep the Jewish people alive, and they started persecuting the spiritual observance, and particularly Jewish education, which we'll come to a bit later. So again, the Second Temple was destroyed 69. Beitar fell 133. So where does Rabbi Akiva fit into all of this? Rabbi Akiva was born in the year 50. So he was a young teenager, essentially, he was 19, when the temple was destroyed. But he wasn't yet a sage, as we'll soon see. He only became a sage much, much, much later. But he died in the year 135. So he died very shortly after Beitar fell. He was actually a supporter of Bar Kokhba at the very beginning. He, in fact, thought Bar Kokhba was going to be Mashiach. Bar Kokhba wasn't Mashiach. He fell. It didn't work. And Beitar eventually fell. And then Rabbi Akiva, I think like roughly a year later, actually passed away or was tortured by the Romans, as we'll see later. So that's the rough Jewish history context of Rabbi Akiva. Now, Rabbi Akiva's life was fascinating. And there are so many lessons to learn from the period and the life of Rabbi Akiva. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to focus on three lessons. I hope we'll have time for all three yet. Three lessons that we learned from Rabbi Akiva. And we learn those lessons from the stories, but I'll go through the stories as we go through those various lessons, right? So the first lesson I want to focus on using a modern term, which we've talked about a lot, is the concept of the growth mindset, right? Which we talked about when we did Carol Dweck's work. And the growth mindset in the context of believing in one's ability, or the ability of others, first of all, to grow and not to be locked into who they are, or not to be defined by what appears to be their natural talents, and the belief in our own ability to do that, not define ourselves by what we believe to be our personality or disposition or skill set, and to believe that we have the capacity to grow and to grow with amazing infinite potential, right? Now, how does that come through in Rabbi Akiva's life? So obviously, this is a famous story, but worth going over again, just to fill in the details perhaps you're not aware of. So Rabbi Akiva was born into a very poverty-stricken family. In fact, his father was not really part of the Jewish community originally. He was a convert, a ger. And Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef. His father's name was Yosef. And he grew up very, very ignorant and very poor. And he became a simple shepherd. And the shepherd was, he worked for a man called Kalba Savua. Now Kalba Savua, the Talmud talks about Kalba Savua in other places. Kalba Savua was one of the three richest Jews in Jerusalem. And there's lots of stories about his incredible wealth and his piety and his benevolence and his philanthropy and so on and so forth. But Kalba Savua had a daughter called Rachel, right? Who grew up in Kalba Savua's house, a prominent house, and to use the shidduch language, many prominent shidduchim were open for her, and she could have married a Torah scholar, someone from a great family, someone who was already comfortable, someone who would have become comfortable, supportive for the whole life, and so on and so forth. However, Rachel noticed this young shepherd who worked for her father, who was illiterate, didn't know alphabet, right? He couldn't read Hebrew. Which, by the way, wasn't that uncommon those times, but nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva was certainly one of those. A simple, poverty-stricken shepherd who she saw in him something amazing. And she believed in him. She noticed, she was able to pick up that in this simple, poverty-stricken shepherd lies great potential. And she struck up a relationship with him, unbeknown to her father, and promised him that she would marry him if he committed himself to Torah study. And he did. And they married in secret, without her father knowing. That would have been crazy. Beth, you should do. Risking everything she had, by the way, right? Her father found out shortly afterwards because her father was trying to marry her off, and every shidduch that came up, she refused. Until he chapped, the penny dropped, that she's married already, right? So he kicked her out of the house and disowned her. And she moved in with Rabbi Akiva in a small shack and lived a life of tremendous poverty, and she was fine with that. She just wanted him to learn. Rabbi Akiva kept to his commitment. Rabbi Akiva actually didn't believe in himself originally. He didn't believe that he would actually amount to anything of a Torah scholar, but he made a commitment. So he started to learn a little bit. He became proficient in Aleph Beis, at least. He was able to read Hebrew, I guess say the basic prayers, learn some basic verses in the Chumash maybe, and so on and so forth. And by that time, by the way, he was around 40 years old already. Okay. And then the famous story happened where Rabbi Akiva sees this stream of water where a drop of water had been dropping. It had been dripping on a stone for a number of years and it eventually had made a tremendous hole in the stone. And at that moment, Rabbi Akiva learned that lesson and he said, if a stone, one drop at a time from a spring, can make such an effect on the stone and can make a dent and a tremendous hole, so my brain of stone and my heart of stone, the same thing can happen. The Torah, apparently, he learned, had become compared to water. So one step at a time, drop by drop, I can do it too. I can learn and eventually it'll make a dent. And he started to do that. And eventually, he made up with his wife, Rachel, which was more sacrifice on her part than on his part, to actually separate for a while, to allow him to travel to one of the greatest sages, Rabbi Eliezer HaMadoi, which was in a different town, to learn in yeshiva. She was ridiculed by her friends. She was told she's absolutely crazy. But somehow she had this mission. She believed in Rabbi Akiva, and she knew that greatness was going to emerge. That's exactly what happened. He mastered Talmud. He became a tremendous sage. Many, many, many years later, he finally came back. He came back to the town. He was then known as the famous Rabbi Akiva. And he came back with 24,000 students. Right? There's a very sad but beautiful ending to the whole story, where he comes into the town with his students, and the whole town comes out to greet him, including Kalba Savua, his father-in-law, didn't know that it was his son-in-law. He didn't realize it's the same person. He knew that that his daughter had married a peasant who was going to amount to nothing and was going to always be ignorant and illiterate. And suddenly there's this great sage who had to meet her. As he was about to approach Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva noticed another scene. He noticed that there was a poverty-looking woman who was trying to approach, looking very disheveled and not very well-kept and so on. And he noticed his Talmidim, his students, trying to block her. And he looked up and he sees his wife. So he stops them and he says, please let her come. He put a chair next to him. He sat down. He put a chair for her to sit down next to him. And he turned to his students and he says, I want you to know, it's a very beautiful line, a famous line, Shali v'shelcha shelahi. Whatever I have and whatever you have belongs to her. Right? So that was a very beautiful moment. And at that moment, Kalba Savua realized what's going on. He approached Rabbi Akiva, he asked him forgiveness, and he forgave him, and so on and so forth, and he made a recreated a relationship with him. Okay. So what's behind the story? What did Rachel see? And ultimately, what did Rabbi Akiva see? Right? Because there was a huge, an infinite gap between where Rabbi Akiva was and what he became, right? It wasn't just a little bit of growth. It was like a completely different person. He was an illiterate, ignorant peasant and shepherd, and here he becomes Rabbi Akiva. And again, you have to understand, Rabbi Akiva was didn't become a Talmudic sage. He became one of the greatest Talmudic sages, one of the greatest interpreters of the oral law and halakha and Talmudic learning and so on. But it boils down to the one thing, right? It boils down to how you define another person and how we define ourselves. Rabbi Akiva, Rachel, first of all, refused to define the person by what he was at that time. She had the ability to look deeper into the person and to understand the greatness and the potential that a person has. And we all have that, right? When we talked about the growth mindset, when we had a look at Carol Dweck's work, right, it became so clear, this whole concept, that what we all do, we do with ourselves, and to a large extent we do with other people, sometimes we do with our own children, with our own students, with people that we know, we lock people in to what very quickly becomes the obvious skill set or talent set that they have when they're young. Right? We make assessment, we make judgments, we define, we describe. And we describe the person fitting into that skill set. And that's such a mistake. Why is such a mistake? Because of everything that we've learned. It's a mistake because although we are creations and we have definitions, and it's true, and I've always said this, you've heard me say this many times, that on the other hand, we shouldn't overestimate ourselves, meaning we all have things that we're good at and things that we're not so good at. We all have strengths, we have weaknesses, and that's fine. But within that general definition of our strengths and weaknesses, we have potential which is far greater than we think. The reason for that is because we have a neshama, we have a soul. The soul is a spark of God. The soul is a spark of infinity. So essentially, God creates the human being as a finite human being, but with an infusion of infinity. And it's that infusion of infinity that gives us an ability to go far beyond where we are, or where we think we are, as long as we don't define ourselves by where we are and where we think we are and who we think we are. Because what we are and where we think we are and what our skill set is the garments of the soul, as we spoke about so many times. It's the way we express ourselves. It's not who we really are. Who we really are is that spark of infinity. We really are is that neshama. We really are is that infusion of infinity that God has given us that gives us the ability to go way beyond what we think we're capable of. This is intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, every part of our being. We're just much more capable and we have much more potential than we think we are. It takes that belief in ourselves, and it takes the humility and the strength to take risks, first of all, to risk failure, right? That's very, very much part of the whole growth mindset concept. because we engage in things that we're not so good at the moment, risking possible failure, which inevitably happens, which is good, but it depends how we define. So if we define ourselves by who we are, then failure becomes who we are. That's why people who have the what we call a fixed mindset don't want to grow, because they don't want to engage in things that are difficult, because they don't want to fail, because they will then define themselves by their failure, because they define themselves by what they're capable of doing. So if I fail, that means I'm not capable if I'm defined by the failure, right? So that's the problem. So you need to be able not to define ourselves by failure, rather see failure as a part of growth. That's Rabbi Akiva did in so many different ways, as we'll see. And also it takes the humility to learn from those that can take us to a spot that's beyond ourselves. That's an important part. Right? So the humility aspect is a very, very important part as well. So there's a very, very beautiful, and that's exactly what Rabbi Akiva did, ultimately. There's a very, very beautiful, well, a confusing, initially, on the surface, passage in the Ethics of the Fathers. I might have shared this with you a long time ago, but where the Ethics of the Fathers says like this. I'm going to just read it to you as it seems, as it translates. It doesn't translate very encouragingly at all, but then I'll tell you what the deeper meaning is. The simple meaning of the passage I'm about to share with you is a passage in the Ethics of the Fathers, Perkei Avot, which encourages people to study when they're young. Because it is true that what we study when we're young, we retain better, right? Even the Talmud acknowledges that there's definitely a window of opportunity, meaning we shouldn't rely on the growth mindset to wait until we're 40 years old to start educating ourselves, or 60 years old, whatever the case is. It just means that it's still possible, but it's certainly easier when we're young, right? That's what the Ethics of the Father seems to be saying. So it says the following. Halomet Torah Yeled. If someone studies when they're a child, right? What are they compared to? They're compared to like a clean piece of paper, ink written on a beautiful, pure piece of paper. And it sticks and it lasts and it's very wonderful. It's very wonderful, right? Then the Ethics of the Father continues and says, Halomet Torah Zaken. But if you learn and you study when you're an older person, then it's like ink which is written on parchment which has been rubbed out many, many times. And we know that's not such good parchment and ink doesn't stick so well. So it's not so good, right? Which on the surface is a very discouraging piece of Mishnah, piece of passage of Ethics of the Fathers for many people. What happens if we lost out? What happens if the things we didn't learn when we were young, right? So the Lubavitcher Rebbe once gave a beautiful, beautiful interpretation of this piece of Mishnah. And he said the following, this is what it means, he says. That the Perkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, is not talking about the age of a person. But it's talking about the mindset of the person. And there are young people who are old, and there are old people who are young. The difference between what the Ethics of the Fathers means when it says a young person or an old person, is a young person has an open mind, has a surrendering mind, has a mind where they prepare to learn from other people. They're inquisitive. They want to explore. They want to learn. They want to absorb from others. Whereas an old person, the old meaning the terminology, the description of old, means a person who's set. As sometimes people do when they're a bit older, they say, "This is me. I'm not going to change. It's too late. It's the way I was born. It's the way I'm used to. I've done this for the last 25 years. You're not going to tell me now to do something differently," and so on and so forth. Right? I'm too old for this. Right? Just last week, so I was talking to someone about something, and someone said to me, "If it was 25 years ago, this is what I would do." So I think to myself, "So it's 25 years later, so why can't you do it?" People, 20, I'm already 60, 70, whatever. It's not, right? That's as I can. So the Perkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, tells us, Halomet Torah Yeled. If you learn, if you study Torah, if you study when you're a child, doesn't matter how old you are on the passport. But if you have the mindset of a yeller, if you have the mindset of a child who wants to learn, is inquisitive, right? You see with children, right? Children are the most inquisitive beings. It's just a shame. I don't know when it disappears, but right? But most people does, right? They're scared to learn new things. Children are always, right? That's why they're so impossible, right? So they always go to the things you don't want them to go to. They'll open cupboards. They'll take out things, they'll break things, they'll take things apart, they'll put them back, or they won't put them back, whatever, they can, right? Because they have an exploring mind, they have a desire to learn. So if someone learns when they're a yeled, whatever age they are, they'll succeed. If someone learns when they're zaken, when they're an old person, it means they have a fixed mindset. It doesn't matter how old they are, they might be 10 years old. They're not going to succeed. And Rabbi Akiva was able to develop, at 40 years old, this mindset. At 40 years old, he began to learn, and he became one of the leading sages of the Jewish people. It's incredible. Starting from his wife, Rachel, who saw it in him, believed in him, believed that it could happen, and obviously it had to then translate to his own commitment, where he could do that, where he was humble, and we'll see later that Rabbi Akiva was incredibly humble, and he went, and he committed, and he put in the effort, obviously, his hard work. Step by step, it wasn't the transformation that took place overnight, it was like the spring of water, a drop at a time, but a drop at a time penetrates and was able to create a Rabbi Akiva. By the way, this concept of a child, a mindset of a child versus a mindset of an old person, manifests itself in a different thing. There's, you know, there's a section of the Rambam which talks about the laws of study, the laws of learning Torah. And it's a very interesting, the way, you know, the way the Rambam wrote, he wrote everything very structured and very organized. And the Rambam writes, in the, he has a number of chapters, I think it's 8, 9 chapters of the laws of learning Torah, and how one should learn, and how one should distribute their time, and so on and so forth. And the very first law, before he even talks about the obligation for everyone to study, and how one should set aside time every day to study, and so forth, which is such an important concept in Jewish tradition, the first law starts with the law of teaching children, of education. That's a mitzvah to teach children Torah. Right? And one would think, it's funny, you should really start, you should start with the obligation for us to learn, the importance of education, and then a detail of the laws of education is how you have to pass it on to young children. But he doesn't do that. He starts with the laws of teaching young children, and the commentaries explain it's for this reason, to tell us that the whole law, the whole section of the laws of study is based on the first law. You have to teach everyone like they're a child. A child, everyone who learns has to be a child. Right? In fact, in the Shema that we say every day, the source for the obligation to study is on the from the verse. It's from the pasuk, v'shinantam levanecha, you should teach your children. That's how we learn the obligation to study. It's all around this teaching a child, because it's to teach us a lesson that anyone who studies has to be a child, have met the mindset of a child. Right? Now, this concept about not defining yourself by what happens to you or what your skill set is or the superficial and the external manifests itself different ways with Rabbi Akiva, right? Because the tragedy after Rabbi Akiva became such a great sage with 24,000 students is that all those 24,000 students died. You heard the story, right? Yeah. They, with the exception of 5, right? And the Talmud uses the language that they all died within a short period of time, which is the reason we have the Omer, that's why we don't get married during the Omer and so on, that's the minimal mourning that we have to commemorate the death of those 24,000 great people. But they were punished because on their level they didn't respect each other, which is a whole other discussion, but it's an important one, but nevertheless not for today, right? And the Talmud uses the language, V'haya ha'olam shamem, and the world was desolate. Emptiness. And in fact, so much so that the transmission, the chain of transmission of Jewish learning was at risk, a great risk. But it wasn't at risk because at the head of it was Rabbi Akiva. And I mean, you can imagine, a person starts learning at 40, succeeds to such an incredible, just, I mean, if you break it down a little bit in your mind, right? Succeeds such an amazing level, is able to create a following of 24,000 scholarly students, and then they all die, left with nothing. I don't know. I would just give up, probably, right? Throw in the towel. It didn't work. But not Rabbi Akiva. Because Rabbi Akiva never defined himself from the beginning by what happens, by successes, by failures, right? And therefore, coming from this growth mindset comes a tremendous degree of resilience. Where you can lose 24,000 students, you have only 5 left, and Rabbi Akiva says, no problem, we start again. We start again. And he started again. And out of that came the Talmud. And out of that came Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which is one of the 5 students that was left, right? An amazing sage in his own right. The author of the Zohar, the source of the Kabbalistic learning that we have today. So we have everything about Jewish learning today, the Talmudic learning, and the halachic learning, the midrashic learning, and the Kabbalistic learning, which came from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, all because Rabbi Akiva refused to give up. Was he at pain? Of course he was at pain. He had tremendous pain. You can imagine losing 24,000 students. But he refused to give up. The resilience that he had was the most incredible thing ever. He started again, and we have Torah, teachings of Torah, and our survival because of that. Right? Same concept, same idea. Refusing to give up. Refusing not to be defined by one's own talents. In other words, not to be defined by the superficiality internally, and not to be defined by what happens externally, but be defined by who I am and what I can achieve. And as long as I'm alive, I keep achieving. As long as the candle burns, we keep studying, as I think the story I told you a few weeks ago. Did I tell you the story? No? Well, I'll tell it somewhere else. The story of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, who saw a tailor working late at night. He says, why are you working late at night? And he says, as long as the candle's burning, I can see, I got to keep working. And he said, he learned from that a tremendous lesson. As long as our soul is still alive, we can keep accomplishing, right? We don't define ourselves by what happened yesterday, but what happened a year ago, but what could happen, what didn't happen. We just keep moving and keep progressing. And that's what Rabbi Akiva did. He rebuilt, and he rebuilt in an unbelievable way. Now, I said before that this is connected to the concept of humility. Right? And it's connected to two things which we find by Rabbi Akiva. Humility. And also we know that Rabbi Akiva placed a tremendous emphasis on the verse in the Torah called Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Love your fellow like yourself. So much so that the famous Rashi's comment in Chumash on that verse where it says Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your fellow like yourself. Rashi makes one comment and he says, Amar Rabbi Akiva, a famous quote from Rabbi Akiva, Ze klal gadol b'Torah. This is a very, very important rule in the Torah. Now it's the foundation of Torah. Why so? Because to have that growth mindset, as we said, number one, one needs humility. Humility means not to have ego, not to be locked in ourselves, to make room for someone else, for something else, and to learn from others. But also to learn from friends, learn from colleagues, learn from other people, to make room for another human being. That takes humility. When you make room for another human being, that concept, getting rid of ego and making room for someone else, is the basis of Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Why? Because it's what creates division between us is our own insecurity, because we define ourselves by the little self that we are, and therefore we protect that little self. But when we understand the depth of who we are, which is the neshama, we understand the soul, we understand the infinity of the soul, we understand our potential, it's that infusion of godly infinity which I have, but so do you, and everyone has. And it's strong, and it doesn't need to be secure, it doesn't need to be protected, and therefore we're able to make room for other people without undermining ourselves, and we're able to connect to other people, and we're able to fulfill Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. That's all connected. Humility, Avat Yisrael, the ability to learn, the growth mindset, all those things are actually intertwined with each other. And therefore we find many stories. I'll just give you one, an incredible story. I mean, it's a simple story, but it's an incredible idea. Of Rabbi Akiva and how humble he was. And even when he became the great sage. So you could say, you know, some people are humble when they need to learn. So of course they need to be humble. They realize that they are not in the top class, so they got to go to someone and to learn. But Rabbi Akiva became the teacher. But he remained humble. Because what got him there in the first place was humility. And humility, well, it doesn't always stay, but if you work at it, it stays. Right? And there's a story that Rabbi Akiva once came somewhere, and he came to a congregation, and the congregation asked him to please lead the congregation in reading a portion of the Torah. And he refused. And afterwards, his disciples said to him, our master, they said, I mean, you've taught us that reading Torah, learning Torah, giving a shiur, is our life, right? That was Rabbi Akiva taught, that our whole life is about learning. That's what Rabbi Akiva stood for. So how come you refuse to lead the congregation in the reading of the Torah? And he said, believe me, I had not prepared myself, for no man should address the words of Torah to the public unless he has first revised them to himself 3 or 4 times. What an incredible lesson. A great Rabbi Akiva, right? Some people, they think, well, they've learned a little bit, no, they'll pull that out of the sleeve. One guy once told me, you know, he gives a shiur and he says, no one lives in the city, don't worry. But he gives a shiur, he says, you know, I prepare it on the way in the car. And I think to myself, like, why are you telling me this? It's not a great compliment. Right? Maybe you're very talented. Maybe you do pull out of your sleeve a bit, but you should never do that. Right? A few years ago, we had a guest from Melbourne. He's staying in my house, and he was here for a Shabbos in the shul. He's a very big Torah scholar, and he's at Rosh Hashiva in Melbourne, and a person I greatly respect. And he gives a shiur every Shabbos morning in a particular text. And I asked him to give the same shiur here. And it's on the parsha of the week. And he did, and I saw him at my house. He asked for that sefer, that book of that particular text. And I see he's like really preparing it. And I knew that he'd given the same shiur, I don't know how many times. And I was just blown away because every time you give it, I know my father-in-law was the same way. My father was an unbelievable Torah scholar. And I used to see it, I used to see him, like he had a curriculum in his yeshiva. There was a certain class that taught Hasidic philosophy. And for like 10 years, they taught the same text every year, different people. But that was the curriculum, right? It's like, you know, you teach book 7 of math to the 7th grade. An experienced teacher has been doing it now for 15 years. And he would sit there in his dining room and he would sit and prepare. And I asked him, you know this stuff backwards. He says, you never walk into a class unprepared. But those people I'm talking about are humble people because you never know. First of all, you need to revise, you freshen your own memory. You need to maybe come to a greater depth. Just because you taught it last year, maybe you can teach it better this year. Maybe you need to come with new ideas, new insights. You have to grow yourself. Maybe your new students will be beneficiaries of your experience. Right? You know what they say about experience, right? Experience doesn't mean you do the same thing 30 times. You do something different 30 times, right? That's experience, right? A teacher or a scholar, whatever, a leader, who just gives the same shiur for 30 years or the same lesson for 30 years, that's not experience. That's doing the same thing 30 times. Experience means you do it differently 30 times, right? So the great Rabbi Akiva was so humble that he said, I'm not going to stand up because I'm not prepared to do it unless I prepared myself 3 or 4 times. An incredible thing. So that's the growth mindset. That's the ability to grow. That's the pursuit of growth. No matter how old you are, how young you are, no matter what your circumstances, no matter what happens, you just keep moving and you keep growing. And you believe in the potential of others and yourself to keep growing. So that's lesson number one. Lesson number two is Rabbi Akiva had this amazing ability to always see the bigger picture and to see the good that could potentially come, or to recognize that there could be good coming. So just a little story first of all before we get to where we see it so incredibly. A little story, the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Akiva had this phrase. This phrase was that Kol ma da'avid rahmana latav hu da'avid. Whatever God does is always for the good. So Rabbi Akiva wanted to bring this out to his students, so he told them the following story that happened to him. That he says he once was traveling, and he had to stop, it was coming dark, and he stopped at a particular village, or just outside a village, and he was looking for somewhere to stay during the night. And it wasn't a particularly kind village, and he knocked on a number of doors, and no one would give him lodging for the night. No one gave him a place to stay. So he was forced to go and sleep in the field outside the city, outside the outskirts of the city, and he had three things. He had a donkey, he had a candle, and he had a rooster. Why do we have those three things? Because Rabbi Akiva never stopped studying. So he had a candle that he was able to light to be able to study through the night, or through part of the night. He had a rooster that when he did fall asleep eventually, the rooster would wake him up. That was his alarm clock. And he had a donkey to keep traveling. Says the Talmud, a wind came and blew out his candle. And you know, in those days, you didn't just pick up matches and start again. You had to have the right material, which he didn't have. So he said, whatever God does is for the good. Suddenly a cat came and ate the rooster. So he didn't have an alarm clock. And then a lion came from somewhere and devoured the donkey. And he was left with nothing. And he said, Kol ma da'avid rahmana, everything God does is for the good. And he went to sleep. He couldn't learn. Didn't have a donkey, didn't know how he was going to get anywhere the next day. He's going to have to walk because he doesn't have a donkey. Doesn't have a rooster. Whenever he gets up, that'll be it. And he was completely stranded. He went to sleep. In the morning, he woke up and it was daylight. He went close to the city and found out that during the night, the city had been attacked by bandits. All the houses had been ransacked and many people had been killed. Had he had the light, had he had the rooster, had he had the donkey, which would have made noise, or the candle, which would have made light, it would have attracted attention and been subject to their attack. Or had he been given lodgings in the night, he would have been under great danger. So he turned to his students, he says, no, whatever God does is for the good. Right? Where did this come up in a most amazing way? So we find two things which I'm going to share with you. One is a story which I've shared with you before, but it's this famous story told about Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues who traveled to Jerusalem, and they were on the Temple Mount, right? And they came to the Temple Mount, and they all tore their clothes, because that's the law. When you see the ruins of the temple, you're supposed to tear your clothes. Many people still do this today. When they go to the Kotel, they do Kriya. If they come during the week, if it's not Shabbat, whatever the case, if they haven't been there for a long time, whatever the case is. Because the temple's still not destroyed and Temple Mount is still has other activities happening on it. Put it that way. So they came, and when they came there, they were able to see the spot which was called the Holy of Holies. And they saw a fox running around there. And they all started to cry, and Rabbi Akiva started to laugh. But note that he had also torn his clothes. In other words, the destruction bothered him as much as it bothered everyone else, right? And this wasn't long after the destruction of the Seventh Temple. I told you the historic context, right? So Rabbi Akiva started to laugh. So they turned to him and they say, "Why are you laughing?" So he says to them, "Why are you crying?" To which they say, I'm saying this story briefly because I've shared it with you before, but they say, well, this is the holiest spot. This is the spot about which it is written in the Torah that no one is allowed to go there except for the high priest on Yom Kippur. And now foxes are running around and we shouldn't cry. So he said, that's why I'm laughing. Why? Because he brought two prophecies that are written in Tanakh, one about destruction, one about the rebuilding of the temple, which will eventually take place. And he said, now that I saw the destruction, I see the second prophecy happening. In other words, the point of the story was that Rabbi Akiva had this incredible ability, and it comes with many, many stories of Rabbi Akiva in the Talmud, where we see this emphasized ability that he didn't see challenge as challenge. He understood the challenge, he felt the challenge, but he saw it as part of the rebuilding. He saw it as part of growth. He saw, when he looked at the destruction, which was painful, he tore his own clothes just like everyone else did. But yet he smiled, because what he saw deeper. He didn't see the current pain. He saw it as a stepping stone. He saw that it's part of the journey of growth. He believed in the rebuilding of the third temple, which will, God willing, take place soon. But he saw that destruction as part of the building of the temple. And that's why he left. And when he said that to them, they turned to him and they said to him, "Akiva nechamtanu, Akiva nechamtanu, Akiva, you have comforted us. We have learned a tremendous lesson." And that's an incredible lesson for everyone, right? The other thing is an amazing thing, which I once heard many, many years ago from someone. You know, I told you that Rabbi Akiva was an unbelievable Talmudic sage, able to interpret the Torah. Now, I don't know if you know, I don't have a thing here, but I just drew it just to show you. You know, in the Torah itself, we have different letters, right? And there's a law how you have to write all different letters. And some of the letters is about seven or eight letters that have to have little crowns upon them. They look like this. This is like I'm not very testy, but this is it's not one of my strengths. This is the letter Zion. You see these two, sorry? Yeah, probably. It's not one of the things I'm probably going to do, but right, you see those three things on the top of the letter? So many letters in the Torah have these like three little crowns on top, right? We call them tagin. And Rabbi Akiva was so knowledgeable, and his depth of Torah knowledge was so unbelievable that he was able to learn something from the crowns. And it says he was able to interpret the little crowns and the letters, because don't forget the Torah is the written letter. And we have the oral Torah, which is interpretation. He was able to interpret many concepts and many laws and many things from the crowns and the letters. Okay, that's what it says. But when it says that, there's a very strange language that the Talmud uses. Because these things, we call them tagin, which are crowns. But when it tells us about Rabbi Akiva interpreting these crowns, it doesn't call them tagin, it calls them something else. It calls them kotsim, which is thorns. Because in fact, they do look like thorns a bit. They're little things that stick out, right? And the Talmud says that I'll call kots v'kots on every single thorn, i.e. little crowns that are in the Torah. Rabbi Akiva was able to interpret mountains of Jewish learning, Jewish concept, from the little crowns, the little thorns on the letters. So I once heard a shiur from someone many, many years ago. They asked the question, he says, why does the Talmud refer to it as thorns? It's such a negative, it's a negative imagery. Thorns are things that injure, they're things that stick, right? Why doesn't it call them crowns or tagin as we call it? And the answer is no, it specifically calls it thorns. Because Rabbi Akiva lived in a time, especially later in life, as we'll soon see, he lived in a time of tremendous thorns. He lived in a time of oppression. And what the Talmud is telling us in a deeper way, that Rabbi Akiva never saw the oppression as oppression. He saw it as an opportunity for growth. And I'll call kots v'kots on every single thorn. He was able to build mountains of Jewish learning. Which is, by the way, the story of the Talmud generally. Not just Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva emphasizes in a great way. But the Talmud, which is the conglomeration of learning that we have today, which is the basis of all Jewish learning, right? Anything you'll ever learn at a shiur or in a book is all rooted in the Talmud, right? That Talmud was authored in one of the worst times in Jewish history. Right? The generations of oppression, of persecution, of bans of Torah study, and so on and so forth. And that's where it emerged. That's where these unbelievable scholars emerged, and that's where this unbelievable body of academic learning and Jewish learning emerged. And Rabbi Akiva showed the way. He said, I'll call kots to the kots on every thorn, not just about the crowns, on every thorn and every challenge he was able to build, because he saw the challenge as a part of building. Right? Now, we're not on Rabbi Akiva's level. Even his colleagues weren't on his level because they cried. But nevertheless, the lesson is something we can try and absorb. We wake up every day knowing there's going to be, hopefully not bad things, but challenges along the way, right? I think I want to share this with you. You know, one of the morning blessings we say in the morning to thank God for the simple blessings of life is to the ability to see, right? We thank God for the ability to see, but we also use a very strange language there. We say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, we bless God, Pokeach Ivrim, that you open the eyes of the blind. It's a very strange way to say, why don't we bless God for giving us eyes to see, right? Open up but the commentary, I think it's the Abarbanel, who says, that's not just a blessing, it's a prayer. Where we ask God, of course we can physically see, but we ask God, we wake up in the morning, we're about to face a day where not everything is going to go 100% okay. Minor things, maybe. Hopefully only minor problems. But there'll be little problems along the way. We ask God, Pokech Ivrim, they should open up the eyes of the blind. We shouldn't be blind. Blind means we'll see what happens, but we might see it negatively. But we should be able to see the blessing, to see the opportunity, to see the growth that can come out of those little challenges. We're not on Rabbi Akiva's level, but he was able to do it with unbelievable persecution. But we can at least do it with small little things. So that's the second concept that we learn from Rabbi Akiva and the period of Rabbi Akiva, that he was able to see the ruins, but see the growth, see the good, see the bigger picture, know there's a bigger picture, and see the bigger picture, and believe in the bigger picture. Finally, I think we cannot talk about Rabbi Akiva without the final lesson of Rabbi Akiva, and that is that, again, I go back to the very beginning of the history, little history lesson that I gave you, and that is towards the later years of Rabbi Akiva, the Romans really got tough, not just on physical persecution, but spiritual persecution, right? Why? Because they realized what we all need to realize, right? The Romans learned this from their own mistakes, but the Romans learned that actually the secret to Jewish continuity is Jewish education. And I say Jewish education, that term is always used about little kids, but it's not about kids. Jewish education for every human being, right? You know, we all talk about Am Yisrael Chai and Am Yisrael Ischai. We will live forever. But if we, that's as a nation, but as individuals, everyone talks about Jewish continuity and how we're going to keep the chain going and how we're going to engage people and so on and so forth. So the Romans taught us this lesson. And Rabbi Akiva enforced this lesson. How did the Romans teach this lesson? They destroyed a whole infrastructure of the Jewish nation, and a couple of generations afterwards, or not long afterwards, they realized they made a big mistake. That the Jewish life, the Jewish vision, the Jewish mission, the Jewish chain was alive and well. They thought that they were just moving a couple of rabbis from Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Yavne, to set a little yeshiva, let them go have their little yeshiva, gesundheit, they can have their little academy of learning, they can sit and learn. But you know, Judaism is about the temple, it's about the court, it's about the Jewish infrastructure, Jewish leadership. We'll destroy that, the Jews will be finished. They won't have a temple, and the temple was the headquarters. And by the way, the temple being destroyed was a terrible thing. We pray every day for its rebuilding, right? That's part of our belief. Because it was a model of spirituality, it was a place of inspiration, it was a place of God's presence, and it's the ultimate where it should all happen. But even the destruction of the temple will not destroy us, as long as there's Jewish learning. And it took the Romans a couple of years to chop this, but they realized that it's fine, they're flourishing. There's Rabbi Akiva, he's got 24,000 students, then he rebuilds again, and he's teaching in the centers, and they know what to do. So they realized, no, they made a mistake. They've got to ban Jewish education, not just the temple, not just the physical infrastructure, not just the physical comfort of the Jewish people, because Jewish people are resilient, they'll overcome that. They have to ban and they have to get rid of Jewish learning. And they tried very, very hard. And they almost succeeded. But the person who led the very rebellion against that was Rabbi Akiva. Because Rabbi Akiva was imprisoned. Ultimately, he was tortured to death. He was one of the, let's say, end of his life. He was one of his, one of what we know, the 10 martyrs called Asara Arugim Malchut. He had a terrible ending and a terrible gruesome death. But to the last moment, he never stopped learning. He learned even when he was imprisoned. And he got a, and he defied the Romans. And he said, no, we have to keep learning. And he said, if you tell me to stop. And some of his colleagues challenged him. He said, why are you putting yourself in such danger? You know what's going to happen to you. And he said, if I stop learning, it's like taking a fish out of the water. He gave a whole analogy, but the bottom line is, it's like taking a fish out of the water and saying, you know, you're safer out here on dry land. Yeah, fish might be safer. Maybe the fishermen won't come and fish him out. But if he's on dry land, he's guaranteed to die. Right? And because Rabbi Akiva taught us that Jewish learning is the very basis. Of course, Jewish observance, which is the learning brings to it, and Jewish engagement, and all types of Jewish experience is so important. But at the foundation of Jewish existence, Jewish continuity, Jewish transmission, is the importance of educating ourselves, of learning God's wisdom, of engaging ourselves in the wisdom and the perspectives and the mindset and the attitude of the way it's taught to us through the written Torah and primarily through the oral Torah. And that's what Rabbi Akiva stood for. And his inspiration, he died. He was killed as a result. But the legacy and the inspiration remained, and the commitment to learning never, never stopped. And there were times in Jewish history where this repeated itself. There was times in Jewish history where, this is during the Crusades, another fascinating time of Jewish history, a tragic time, where the enemies understood the same thing. They couldn't squash the Jews. What did they do? It was before the printing press. They decided that they're going to burn the Talmud. I don't know if you know this, right? And in France, there were a time, I think it's 1100s, 1200s, where they burnt 24 wagons of manuscripts, right? And there was only one or two left, and it's actually a big miracle. Not only the Talmud, but they burnt manuscripts of great commentary, which we have on the Talmud, called the Tosfot, which we almost lost as a result. But there was someone who had still one manuscript, and they managed to resurrect it, and we always manage. But this is what our enemies understood. But the lesson for us from Rabbi Akiva is that we need to understand that. And we need to understand that, by the way, if you think this is a commercial for Bina, it is. It's true. Not just Bina, all Jewish learning. Right? But it certainly is the inspiration for Bina, right? But we always need to upgrade our learning, because actually that we call the people the book for a reason. Right? That is, if you look carefully at Jewish history, that actually is the secret to Jewish continuity. So those are the three lessons of Rabbi Akiva. Growth mindset, always looking at the bigger picture, and the commitment to education. Have a good day. Yes.